You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
For us in Germany, this means that every debate about a Brexit must now belong to the past. No moaning. No more moaning about the past. No finger pointing. No accusations. And no return to the game of Greece leaving the Eurozone.
Germany's Vice Chancellor Sigmar Gabriel thinks Greece has been retrieved from the brink as the Bundestag approves talks on another bailout. Is his optimism justified? My guests Xenia Wickett and Nina Schick will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the resurgence of Euroscepticism on the European left. How far has the landscape shifted? Also,
we remain committed to steps that contribute to peace and tranquility on the border. But if there is unprovoked firing, if there is infiltration, if there is cross-border terrorism, there would be a response.
Indian Foreign Secretary Subramaniam Jaishankar on renewed tension and more deaths in Kashmir. Is there any lasting solution to be had? And are Nawaz Sharif and Narendra Modi the men to find it? And Barack Obama speaks up about the United States' absurdly overcrowded prisons. But will anyone listen to him? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Xenia Wickett, who's the project director of the US program at Chatham House, and Nina Schick, the director of communications at the EU policy think tank Open Europe. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Greece, which now appears to be on the verge of locking down its third umpty billion euro bailout in 5 years after Germany's Bundestag approved talks towards such a deal. It was not, however, an unalloyed triumph for Chancellor Angela Merkel on her 61st birthday. Among the 119 MPs opposing were 60 members of her own conservative bloc. Nina, it now does seem that the bailout will happen. France, Finland and Austria's parliaments have also voted yes. But looking forward, are we just in yet another round of delaying the inevitable?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it that this deal is a typical European fudge, extend and pretend, if you will. We've seen it happen over the years and we've seen it happen again, because obviously the dedication to the European project is such that even when economic reality is shaking you in the face, you still want to continue down the path of keeping the euro together. The problem is that Greece has unsustainable debt level. Almost IMF predicts that it'll soon be 200% of its GDP. On that regard, you know, what Athens was calling for, what Syriza was calling for, one can understand why they would call for a haircut, why they would call for debt relief, because Greece needs it. And even the IMF has said so. However, given the construct of the euro, that would essentially, the counterfactual to austerity in Greece would be fiscal transfers. And that's illegal, because then the rest of the eurozone is permanently paying for the bad debts of another country. And in countries like Germany, the population was only convinced to give up their beloved Deutschmark on the ironclad promise that they would never permanently have to pay for the bad debts of other countries. So, and that's also in the treaties. So there you have a lose-lose situation for Greece. The best you can have is extend and pretend, where they lend more to borrow to pay off their debts, and you're just kicking the can down the road. And as we've seen in the past 6 months, the political uncertainty that comes along with that can often rattle the rest of Europe.
And one should not need, you would not think, to lecture Germans about the dangers of economic uncertainty, especially ones with memories as long as Angela Merkel's. Xenia, she warned this week of chaos if these talks and this bailout wasn't approved. As opposed to what?
As opposed to chaos. But there's the chaos we know, and there's the chaos we don't know. And you know, I mean, you often talk about better the devil you know than the devil you don't. And the reality is that right at the moment, the consequences of Greece leaving are uncertain. And that is very, very scary. And so keeping Greece in is the way forward. But it's not just an economic question that we should be answering. So, I agree with much of the economics that Nina talks about. Although I will say, having worked in government, nothing is ever ironclad. Nothing is ever absolute. in government. Everything has a certain amount of wiggle room. And if you read some of the newspapers, they will say there is a certain amount of wiggle room in the treaties to find a way to allow Greece effectively to default and others to pay. But this isn't just economic. This is also political. And what the fear is, and some fear that actually we've maybe moved too far already, some fear that if Greece were to move out of the euro or Grexit, move out of Europe entirely, and those two things aren't necessarily absolutely tied together, although, you know, most likely. But if they were to move out of Europe, there would be huge political consequences for Europe, and it would weaken this thing that is Europe, this thing that we have been trying to strengthen, or many have been trying to strengthen now for decades. And so, as well as consider the economic consequences of this, we do actually have to consider the political consequences of this, which is that if Greece were to leave, would others eventually leave? Even if others don't, does it remove this ideal that upon which Europe was founded?
Perhaps I wasn't clear enough. The point that I was making is that it's precisely politics over economics, because if you look at it just from the economic side, it makes no sense for countries as different as Germany and Greece to be in the same currency union. But because this is primarily a political project, you know, they've done everything to keep Greece in, even though it economically doesn't make sense. And in the construct of the euro, Greece can't be given the debt relief that it needs. And of course, that is the fear. If Greece were to leave, then you set a precedent whereby a club which was only meant to have people joining, never leaving, now is a club where people can leave. And that shatters, you know, the European project, very much so. And of course, there's all the geopolitical risks as well about, you know, fears about Russia, which is, of course, what the US is very concerned about. And also, but having said that, it's also political in the sense that they couldn't be lenient on Greece, because if they had given Greece a lighter deal or somehow managed a way to restructure their debt, the risk of political contagion in the rest of the eurozone is very, very high. We have anti-austerity parties not only in Greece, but also in Spain. Remarkably, Podemos, which is a party only founded last year, now at 25% of the vote. Spain goes to, they have their elections later this year. What happens when Spain starts saying that they want debt relief, that they want some of their debts written off?
Zania, the first reforms will begin to make an impact as soon as Monday. VAT on many items in Greece will be up from 13% to 23%. The banks will reopen, we're being told, although there will be limits for the foreseeable future as to how much money people can withdraw for obvious reasons. Are we going to get to the point where the Greek people realise that they're actually possibly even worse off than they were a month, 6 months, a year previously, with absolutely no end in sight? And at what point does that become politically unsustainable?
Well, it's not clear that, I mean, I would imagine that many of them already realise that's fairly transparent. The agreement that Tsipras reached this week, I haven't yet read any kind of article or listened to any news story that says it isn't far worse than the Greek people rejected a week earlier. So the idea that the Greek people don't know that this is going to be really tough. And you know, part of the problem, and this is, I think, where many of the other countries within Europe objected to Tsipras's desire and decision to go to the Greek people in a referendum, is, you know, you've asked people what they want, they've said what they want, and then you've ignored it, you know, and the idea that he went to the people with I can do better if you give me the power to do it, this doesn't mean an exit from Europe, that clearly was untrue. And that's what we've found, is that clearly was untrue. And what people have said is, we want Europe, but we don't want austerity. And what the Greek people have been told is, I'm sorry, with Europe comes austerity.
Well, Merkel said as much herself that Tsipras won on two promises to end austerity and stay in the euro, and he can't have both.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we'll move along from that to a curious, possibly resonant subplot of the Greek imbroglio, which has been a strange and sudden eruption of Euroscepticism among the traditionally pro-EU European left and centre-left. The spectacle of the EU combining with such traditional left-wing bogeymen as the IMF to shake Greece by its ankle seems to have prompted a variety of reflexively pro-EU voices to wonder whose side they should really be on. Here in the UK, we have seen a group of seven MPs from across the spectrum, Labour, Conservative and indeed UKIP, announcing that they will combine to campaign for an out vote in the promised referendum. Nina, I'll ask you first. I mean, this has been a strange subplot. There has always been a sort of semi-buried Eurosceptic tendency on the left, especially in Britain, where the Labour Party did campaign in 19, or part of the 83 manifesto, the famous longest suicide note in history, was a promise to get the UK out of the EU. Has it just become muted because people on the left are scared of being bracketed with populist right-wingers who have adopted Euroscepticism as their pet cause?
Well, traditionally, as you correctly point out, you know, the Labour Party was very much against the European community before it developed into the fully fledged EU, because they saw it as a global liberal economic project which would take away, you know, workers' rights, social rights, etc., things like that, until Jacques Delors, one of the great architects of the European Union, came over and gave a speech to the British unions promising that they were going to build a social Europe. And that was really the turning point. You know, the rights of workers would be enshrined and protected. And then traditionally after that, you know, Labour, the British left, has been very much in favour of the European project. Now, so that has never really gone away in the Labour Party, but that wing has become less loud and they've become less visible. But recently, of course, the British left is going through a shake-up of its own. And seeing what's happening in Greece has certainly led for this voice to rise up again. And it's very interesting to see how the unions are taking a voice and being quite Eurosceptic. There are more than one group. There are several groups now of Labour-led MPs and even a shadow minister saying they're going to campaign for Brexit or Britain to leave the EU.
Zinia, how damaged do you think the EU idea has been among its traditional supporters on the left by the events of the last few weeks in particular?
I think that the last few weeks have left and right, the brand of the EU has gone through enormous upheaval over the last few months and actually years, and I think that is going to take a long time. It's what we were talking about earlier. It's going to take a long time for that brand to kind of regain any of the shine, if it does at all, because, you know, as we were saying earlier, we've now started to question things we thought were just unquestionable, if you will. But I think this idea of left and right, I mean, I spend most of my time looking at American politics, you know, and we tend to think of, you know, Tea Partyism, for example, as being something that's only on the right. But actually, you've almost got a circular political system where actually there's some Tea Partyers on the left-hand side as well. You know, isolationists, you know, best manifest by Rand Paul, but you've also got some isolationists on the left. So this idea that, you know, that issues like this really split down along one political faction only just isn't true, and it's only at times like this that actually we're, you know, we're stuck in a stark way to see it in front of us.
Nina, how much, I mean, it strikes me that in this country in particular, every argument about Europe, whether people want to admit it to themselves or not, is somewhere between 95 and 99% an argument about immigration. To what extent is that true across the rest of the continent? Is Britain a special case in that respect, being an island nation?
Of course, the issue of immigration is particularly incendiary here, especially when it comes to the issue of EU migration to Britain. Of course, it's a big issue here, and there's no denying that. However, the issue of immigration as a whole is, of course, a massive issue facing the rest of Europe as well. But not just intra-EU immigration, but also we're talking about the refugee crisis. I mean, you only need to look at what's happening on the shores of Italy and Greece to understand how that's impacting them. But I think, of course, in Britain, because of its demographic, because certain countries in Europe, like Germany, need immigration for demographic reasons, it's seen very differently than here in the UK, where you are an island, there is a limited amount of space, resources are finite, and it's a sticking point in the public debate.
Zinia, Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, said today that he was worried that Europe was, as he put it, in a pre-revolutionary state of mind generally. Here in Britain, as we come towards the referendum, date to be decided, we will see, you know, big business, major media, political establishment, all campaigning to stay in Europe. Have we yet reached the point, not just in Britain, but across Europe, in which that might actually drive more people into the opposite camp? Is Donald Tusk exaggerating slightly or not?
there is a tendency that the minute you start getting, you know, organized government, organized business, you know, big business coming together, there are an awful lot of people who say, well, if they're for it, we're against it, you know. And that's true wherever you sit. That's true whether you sit in the UK, you sit in the US, or you sit in continental Europe. So, I mean, I think there is always that danger. You know, again, you know, one of the things that, you know, the US has been incredibly sensitive over the Scottish referendum to not say, we really want, you know, Scotland and England to stay together. And I think they will be incredibly sensitive not to say we want Britain to stay in Europe in any kind of a really loud public way. Because again, there's the great fear that if they were to do that, that an awful lot of people say, well, if they want it, we don't.
I mean, is it necessary? I mean, is it possibly, I'm trying to be constructive and positive here, I'll ask you, Nina, is it possible that this will actually widen the ongoing debate about Europe? Because Euroscepticism has for so long been a almost exclusive province of the slightly cranky populist right wing. Is there actually a left-wing case, a left-wing Eurosceptic or Euro-reform case, which hasn't been made because people are frightened of being thought of as being in the same camp as the Front National or UKIP?
I think I would disagree with you there, because if you look at the divides across Europe, people questioning the European project, you know, people that make the UKIPs look like teddy bears, basically, it crosses every single group you can imagine, from the left to the right, from the north to the south, regional to national. Everywhere across Europe, people are questioning the European project. And of course, their fears or their worries are wrapped up in their own concerns and demands. And I think the biggest thing you can see from that is that everyone has their own regional interests or their own political interests. And when you try to engulf a region as vast as Europe into one body and do a one-size-fits-all model for 500 million people, inevitably that's not going to work. And the biggest irony on things like the euro, the political project which was conceived to bring the EU together, is that it's driven even more difference into those who've adopted it. So looking forward, I think politicians in Europe really have to show some leadership and say, can we have a model that's maybe a little bit more flexible, where people are able to contribute or integrate to the degree that they're comfortable with? So if some countries want to integrate more, they are welcome to do that. But not everyone has to be given a strict diktat from Brussels, because as we see now, across the political spectrum and across the regions of Europe, that's driving a lot of resentment into Europe. So it's almost like if you don't have a new model, then it'll be too late. It will really lead to the destruction of Europe.
The only thing I would push back a little bit, you know, India, it has a population of 1.1 billion. China has a population of 1.3 billion. The United States has a population of 300 million. Hugely diverse cultures. Hugely diverse cultures. So the idea that Europe, with, as you, I think you kind of rounded it as 500 million, can't actually stick together in some form or another just seems to me. Well, we've seen countries stick together with just as much diversity. No. Now the bit that I agree with you is, does Europe need reform? Absolutely. You know, in the same way that every government needs reform. The question is, do you have to have some elements that are dictated, your word, across, that provide some solid architecture and then reform within that? Absolutely. And that reform process is never, ever going to stop. And as we were discussing earlier, I think that from the perspective of many, Great Britain is best placed to lead that reform. But you can't lead that reform from outside. You can only lead that reform from inside. So there's an awful lot of people who would like to see Britain inside leading reform rather than
I absolutely agree with you, and we work on that day and night. That's what our think tank does. We think Britain should lead in a reformed Europe. However, the difference between the EU and China or America is, of course, that it's not one country. And that's the problem, because if you try to centralize certain things in Brussels and then you have 28 member states saying, we want this, we want that, look at the European response to, for example, the Ukraine crisis. Cannot be a united response. Why? Because
it is a united response, actually. We're doing pretty well on Ukraine.
You think that's a united response. But look at how the splits were on the sanctions, what the Baltics are saying versus countries like Germany. What is Poland saying versus, you know, the United Kingdom? It's inevitably going to have splits. And the same thing for the currency union. If you don't have one centralized state that is able to take these decisions, then inevitably there's going to be conflict between the leaders of the 28 countries. So I think the best model for Europe would be where the EU, of course it should stick together, but they should focus on the big questions like foreign policy, striking free trade deals with the rest of the world.
So Ukraine actually would be something that would be centralized. So it wouldn't be any different than it would be today.
Well, working with NATO, of course, because I mean, the idea of a European army, that's, I mean, what's happened with Ukraine? As soon as Russia, the threat to the Eastern European countries became apparent, America had to step in. The US, we're talking about tanks on the ground, so...
We will have to take a short break now, unfortunately. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Xenia Wickett and Nina Schick. Coming up next, we look at ongoing violence in Kashmir and take a look at the justice system in the United States. Do stay tuned.
Monocle loves books. We love them so much that we have our very own books team in partnership with our friends at Gestalten in Berlin. We've already launched the muscular and handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living and the Monocle Guide to Good Business, plus the London and New York titles in our new hardback City Guide series. And coming your way this summer are the giant Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes, that's packed with inspiring residences and practical advice, and City Guides for Hong Kong and Tokyo too. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. See our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com and on the shelves of all great bookstores.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests for today's Xenia Wickett and Nina Schick. Now, a week ago, Prime Ministers Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan and Narendra Modi of India were photographed shaking hands at the BRICS summit in Ufa and regarding each other apparently affably. Modi even accepted an invitation to attend a summit in Islamabad next year, which would make him the first Indian leader to visit the neighbours in more than a decade. In the last day or so, however, Kashmir has erupted again, at least five civilians killed in exchanges of fire between the two countries. Xenia, first of all, does this latest fracas appear to have been about anything in particular, or is this just the ongoing Kashmir being Kashmir?
This is the ongoing Kashmir being Kashmir. What is interesting is that, as I said, this is ongoing. What is interesting about this is the fact that every time there seems to be any kind of a rapprochement between the two sides, what is very, very clear is that there are people on both sides who do not want to see any rapprochement. The Indian side don't want to see it in the military, because actually part of why they spend so much in the military is because of Pakistan. The same goes for the Pakistani side. There are people on both sides, individuals on both sides, who believe very strongly that Kashmir is Indian, or Kashmir is Jammu and Kashmir is Pakistani. And so there are always people who are trying to prevent any rapprochement. The only way that you will actually get an extended rapprochement is if the leadership of both sides actually decide not to empower effectively those against rapprochement and say we're going to keep going regardless. Now, with the arrival of Modi just over a year ago now, there was some indication that he would have a fairly hawkish position, but that he was also very keen on engaging his neighbours. He invited all of his neighbours, including the Pakistanis, to his inauguration.
Indeed so.
So it's going to be interesting to see whether he can, you know, they often say that the most hawkish are the ones most able to make compromises, most able to engage. If I go back to about 2007, you know, there was a... It was clear that the leadership on both sides at that time, Musharraf on the Pakistani side and Manmohan Singh on the Indian side, actually privately had a deal to how to move forward together. And then, of course, Musharraf blew himself up quite effectively and got himself chucked out of the country or demoted. And, you know, that was put back in the drawer. So the question is, can these two leaders actually... revitalize some kind of a process of engagement?
I mean, Nina, is this one of those ones which you kind of can sympathize with both Modi and Sharif on this, because they both must realize that if they invest in a peace process in Kashmir, that will be the thing they do with their time in power, with very, very little guarantee or arguably chance of any significant success. Is it likely that they would both be willing to take that on at the same time?
I don't know if I'm too optimistic about, you know, a real lasting peace there, because I'm half South Asian, and of course this goes back to all the way to partition, and that left such a deep scar on South Asia and what modern South Asia is. And until then, you know, sectarian violence, like the sectarian violence we see on the subcontinent between Hindus and Muslims, was relatively, it's quite a new phenomenon. It's a 20th century phenomenon. And so many vested interests play a role in that I don't think, given all the competing groups and parties and positions, that you can ever have a lasting peace there. I think it'll continue to flare up.
I mean, is there just a brief final thought on this one, Xenia? Is there a small first step that India and Pakistan could usefully take?
Well, they're already doing it. I mean, you can talk about. I mean, in terms, the small first step is actually talking. Now, you've got a foreign secretary on the Indian side, Jaishankar, who, incredibly smart, came from being the ambassador to the United States, really knows the issues. You know, if anybody can think strategically about this, he can. You know, Pakistan has a whole host of problems on energy, on corruption, on the role of the military, on security, on economics. India, Modi, is very, very focused on economic growth. And so the question is, can they actually find some common ground, probably in the economic space, to actually make progress while the rest they let just quietly winnow away, hopefully?
Okay, well, finally tonight, yesterday, President Barack Obama became the first sitting president of the United States to visit one of his country's federal prisons. It is, of course, at least arguable that Richard M. Nixon, for one, should have done this sooner and been compelled to stay rather longer. But Obama's outing to the medium-security El Reno prison in Oklahoma was intended to illustrate what should be obvious, which is that the U.S. locks up far too many of its own citizens, not always with terrifically good reason. Nina, it's shocking every time you look at it. It is the most enthusiastic prisoner of its own people anywhere in the world. 724 per 100,000 citizens, ahead of Russia in second place on 581. Why is this not, you know, an ongoing scandal that consumes front pages every day? It's absurd.
It is absurd. And I saw an infographic today which really crystallized the scale of, you know, how many people are imprisoned in the U.S. They basically took all the states of the U.S. as if they were countries. And you had 36 U.S. states before you had another country, and that was Cuba. New York comes just before Rwanda, and Rwanda is obviously still putting people into prison for the awful genocide in the 90s. So the scale of the problem is absolutely stunning, really. Blows one's mind. But I think it's also quite a problem on the state level, from what I've seen and what I understand of the situation. But what I also seem to understand is the mood seems to be shifting, at least towards a little bit more reform of these systems.
One of the problems, and, you know, I mean, this was what was so interesting, I think it was yesterday also, President Clinton, former President Bill Clinton,
continuing his ongoing apology tour.
Continuing his ongoing apology and said, you know what, my three strikes crime bill that he put in place in 94 was wrong. You know, and so a lot of the people who've been locked up have been locked up for reasons that I think most rational people say this is absolutely lunatic, but that's what the legislation demanded. So to the extent that, you know, President Obama has 18 months left and he can do something about this, that would be absolutely fantastic. Now, the question is, President Obama is also trying to get through trade agreement. He's also trying to get through an Iran deal. You know, he's trying to move through environmental issues. Immigration, he would like to move on. Can, you know, is this high enough priority, or is this not sensitive enough that actually this is something that can get done because other sensitive things aren't going to get done? That's the real question.
Final very brief thought on this, Nina. Is the trouble is that you can't win this argument as a politician, especially as a Democrat, without just getting whacked at being soft on crime by your opposition?
Well, obviously that has a lot to do with the development of this problem, you know, being hard on crime. But I think that from what I've read, there seems to be a little bit of a consensus for reforms to be accepted. And you have a kind of strange left-right coalition almost forming to agree on the need for prison reform.
the thing that will motivate them is budget. Huge budgetary problems on a state and a federal level, and this is costing them a lot of money.
$80 billion, to be precise. We will have to leave it there. Xenia Wickett and Nina Sheikh, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. Produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Gaia Lutz and Elena Nikulacheva. Our studio manager, Chad Childers. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards is here with Monocle's International Playlist. Marcus Hippie is in with the menu at 1900 hours. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson with the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 hours, London. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.